Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Tonight, we have another show that, again, touches on LGBTQ iconic. One thing I think that is the spirit of what we've done in this program is we bring you the latest breaking LGBTQ news, the hot issues that are going on, the things that you should be aware of. And one of the things that you should be aware of is where we come from and the history and the legacy of everything that has come before. And tonight is going to be one of those shows that will possibly be introducing you to a person from the LGBTQ past that you may not be aware of. His name is Hank Martin, and Hank Wilson. He has an incredible history with the legacy of LGBTQ rights. He hails from San Francisco in the 1970s and 1980s, and a couple of filmmakers are looking to document his life and create a new film called Thanks to Hank, and we will be getting to that in just a moment. I want to bring on my co-host, the esteemed Brody Levesque. Good evening, Brody.
Good evening, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing well. Part of the outlook I have tonight is really a bit somber and sober with the yet another shooting in this time in Thousand Oaks, California. It's a community that I know you spent time in, and it's a community that I spent time in. And whenever these things happen, they hit close to home, but they're I think hitting probably a little closer to home for both you and I tonight.
Yeah, it's actually hitting me pretty close to home. My former wife and my children and I lived in Newbury Park next to Thousand Oaks. My wife was a physician, and she was on staff at Los Robles. The particular venue opened up actually a year after we had left, it's kind of really unfortunate with what's happened. That, you know, it's one of those communities it's kind of a mess actually. So, and having lived there, it just really it affects me kind of deeply at this point. To be honest with you, I'm not feeling too good about it.
Yeah, no, I actually worked at the newspaper there for several months back in the day, and I'm very familiar with the community, and I'm familiar with the colleges that a lot of the kids who were in the bar attend, it's just this frustration of again, a situation like this happening and absolutely nothing being done about it from our government to deal with it in any way. And so we'll push forward, but feeling it deep, feeling for the families that are grieving tonight and the community that I'm sure is in shock.
And you know, it, my you know, my heart goes out to the sheriff, and it's just one of those things of the law enforcement community in the Canal Valley. It's really pretty bad, you know. And there you go. I'm kind of
there you go.
A little bit, honestly, at a loss of words, because this is just one of those things where I'm just so sick of this. I'm literally just really tired of it.
Yeah. So no, you and I have talked through several of these so far, and it's there are no new answers to it whatsoever. So let's switch gears here. We had an election this week, and across the country, I believe it's about 100 LGBTQ government leaders have ascended into office in one place or another. Can you give us an overview of your take on the election?
The election was actually it was pretty good for the LGBTQI community from the standpoint that we've got over 100 elected officials across the country, including Two-Spirit Native American in the state of Kansas as a newly minted member of Congress. I think the most significant thing is my friend Jared Polis is the governor of Colorado, and I'm just so pleased with him, and so it's so great. It really is awesome, and you know, for Jared and his husband and his family, and for the people of Colorado, it's great. I mean, I can't think of anything better than that to say. Although, with no amount of irony, I'm also kind of a little bit pleased because the idiot who wouldn't, you know, bake the cake for the gay couple now has a gay governor. So
right.
I'm kind of, you know, excited that Masterpiece Bakery now is, you know, and even more so ground zero, of course, for, you know, the not-so-loyal opposition of the Christian right in Colorado Springs. Now I have to contend with the fact that, you know, there is a governor who is gay and sitting up there, and, yeah, I kind of like that idea too as well.
Yeah, very, so, very good.
And
races, friend Zach Wall got elected. Zach Wall has got elected.
I am so proud of Zach. Zach is someone that I've known, and in typical fashion, he started off as the subject of an interview and then became a friend. And I'm extraordinarily pleased for Zach. He's now Iowa State Senator for District 37, which is around the Cedar Rapids area of Iowa. He'll do a great job. He's an amazing 26-year-old, former Eagle Scout, longtime LGBT ally. His two mothers, Dr. Walls and her wife, I'm sure, are thrilled to death. I'm sure Zebby is really pleased that her brother is where, you know, he's at. So, yeah, from that point of view, like I said, for the LGBTQI community, this election actually was not bad for us. It was a little dicey for everyone else, admittedly, but, you know, for us it wasn't too bad. I think it's important that, you know, people understand that this was kind of critical that these office holders, you know, are now sitting in Congress, and they are sitting in these governorships, and they're sitting in these local offices. And I just think this is really a good thing. So, so the election wise, you know, I think it was okay. We are also just to update you a little bit. Looks like recounts have now been triggered in the Senate and governor race in Florida. And we're still waiting word from Atlanta, but there's a good chance that that governor's race is also going to trigger a recount as well. So it's not over yet. There was a lot of talk about, you know, gains in the Senate, and the gains may not actually happen. It may only be a 1 or 2 seat gain, and that may be the end of it. And then, of course, my colleague and friend Jim Acosta from CNN and the President of the United States mixed it up. And then the president apparently doesn't understand the role that we play in the free press. And he had his press secretary, who I will call out as a lying sack of feces, yank Jim's credentials, you know, and so I'm basically over this White House. You know, it's 2020 can, as far as I'm concerned, come fast enough. Outside of that, it's been one of those weeks. So, yeah, if I'm sounding like I'm a little out of sorts tonight, I really am. I'm heartsick over Thousand Oaks. I am sick of, you know, this. I'll say it plainly, and of course, you and most of our listeners know that I'm a Canadian, but I'll say it plainly. You know, you Americans have a really, 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 really big problem. You guys are sick. And your sickness is that your guns are more important than your fellow citizens, your children's lives. You folks need to cure that rapidly. And someone's like, well, they've got to do this, they've got to do this. Look, it's not going to end. This is going to keep going, okay? It's just going to keep going until someone grows a pair and they get the guns and they license the guns and they regulate the guns and they do what they need to do. And for all those people out there that are going to call in and bitch and Second Amendment this and that, you know what? Don't bother. Screw you. All right, Rob, ran over.
Brody, it always burns my heart that you never tell us what you really think about things. You know, just always that vague guessing game that you play with everybody. I'm kidding. That was a joke. So one thing I do want to point out about the election and actually the discussion about the election is that both you and the editor of the Washington Blade, Christopher Kane, will be on my Out in Santa Cruz show on Saturday night at 7 p.m. on www.ksco.com, and we will go over the election in more detail then. So I'm looking forward to that discussion. Yes. So, and as far as the White House and the press, honestly, I don't even know why you guys still show up for that ridiculous horse and pony show.
Sure.
I mean, I really think you guys should boycott it. It's like it has become coverage of misinformation and what are they saying now rather than any kind of true news source. And I think you should show them a lesson and just simply not show up is my advice.
Before you bring them on, I need to personalize this a little bit. When I was a young, scared 19-year-old, not sure what I was. I knew I was gay, but I wasn't gay, and I had to get away from where I was living at home in Canada. My best friend had fled 6 months earlier, and he brought me to San Francisco. And I arrived, as irony in history would have it, at about 10 o'clock in the morning on a bright, clear day. And at 10 o'clock that night, I'm watching very angry gay people set fire to San Francisco police cars and throwing crap through the front door of City Hall. So my first introduction to your country and to the gay community was the White Night Riots. About a couple months after that, I was sitting on the Castro's street itself, actually, just down the hill from the theater with a group of my friends. And one of the gentlemen that you're going to bring on here in a second was introduced to us. I got to know him a little bit. And after I left San Francisco, we fell out of touch, and we actually didn't reconnect until this year. But he is a renowned photographer. He's an artist. He's extremely well-known in the gay community. And for many people, of course, he's best known as being the person who ran the desk, if you will, of Harvey Milk's Castro Camera, and that is Dan Nicoletta. Of course, when I was introduced to him 40-some years ago, it was Danny Nicoletta. It's obviously we've gotten older, grayer, and a little thicker around the waist, so we that's a little different. But so I was so pleased to be able to, help by bringing Dan on tonight with his friend Bob, who we'll be talking about. To me, Dan represents a direct throwback to a different time, a different era, and a different Brody Levesque. So for me, it's kind of cool just to even reconnect with Dan. And it's even more cool that you're going to have an opportunity to talk to him. He's an amazing person. Most people don't know this, but if you out there in the audience have watched Lance Black's film Milk, the scene at the very end that becomes rather tragic for Harvey, the gentleman that he's talking to in the office when Dan White busts in and says, "I got to talk to you," and then ends up shooting Harvey at that point. But the person in the office that he's talking to, that's actually Dan doing a cameo appearance. So there's a little bit of film, you know, trivia for you. So without any further ado, I'll let you do your hosting duties. But anyway, I want to just put that out there.
Okay. I just want to clarify one thing you just said. Dan himself was not actually in Harvey Milk's office when that happened.
No.
Is
in
that
the
right?
No.
In the film.
Film Milk.
All right.
Yeah, in the film. No. He was not in Harvey's office when that happened, though. Yeah, let's close that up right away. In the film.
We would be having a very much different show tonight if that was the case. But anyway.
Probably
all right.
So. Yeah.
Well, before we get accused of creating fake news here, I do want to bring on our guests and welcome them, Daniel Nicoletta and Bob Ostertag. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Yeah. We just to give you a heads up, we torture our guests by leaving them on hold at the beginning of the show so we can talk about them behind their backs in front of them. Where they can't answer us back. So you guys have been vetted, rated LGBT style. But welcome, welcome. So tell us about Hank Wilson and how he inspired you guys to do a documentary.
Okay. Bob, why don't you go first? Because you can give the overview of the film, and then we can kind of go off on our own little tributaries as needed.
Sure. So usually I write books or I make music. I'm a writer. I've written a number of nonfiction books, and I'm also a composer. I've published about 25 CDs, and I tour internationally pretty much constantly. So this is my first film, and probably my last film. I have no aspirations to become a filmmaker. My only interest here is the memory and legacy of this extraordinary person named Hank Wilson. Hank was a very, very unusual gay man who worked tirelessly behind the scenes in San Francisco. He founded about 25 different organizations, many of which form the institutional backbone of the San Francisco LGBT community today and even the world. He, for example, was one of the people who started the first AIDS candlelight vigil, which is now in 1,200 different community organizations in 115 countries and considered the largest grassroots event in the world. But more than anything, Hank stood for a kind of gay politics that put poor people first and that and stood for a understanding of community that was all about taking care and looking out for the least privileged people. And I feel that's been, you know, in the age of gay marriage and gays in the military and so on, the idea that there was a generation before us that thought about class and poverty first and that tried to use a gay perspective to contribute to a much broader vision of social justice is something that I very much want to keep in the community's memory. I also was very close to Hank, particularly in the latter part of his life. Dan Nicoletta, who's also here on the phone, knew Hank long before I did. Hank's passing was very sad, and I always knew that sort of my life path involved at some point doing some big project for Hank and for Hank's memory. And so I'm very happy to be making this movie.
Wonderful. How did you each meet Hank? How did he come into your lives?
Well, I can say for me, in 1998, when Tom Amiano ran for mayor of San Francisco, and his, for listeners who don't know, Tom was Hank's early collaborator. Tom and Hank did many, many projects together. They started the first gay teachers union in the country, and many other projects. And Tom ran for mayor against Willie Brown in 1998, jumped in the race at the last second, was a write-in candidate with no money, and forced a runoff against Willie Brown, the most powerful politician in California, who Bill Clinton had endorsed, and so on and so forth. So it was this extraordinary write-in insurgent gay campaign. I went in to volunteer, and I walked in. I said, okay, here I am. What should I do? And they said, talk to this guy, Hank, over there. So I went over, and Hank said, okay, why don't you answer the phone? So I sat down. The very first phone call was from the San Francisco Chronicle, the newspaper, asking for a comment on a death threat that had been made against Tom that morning. I put the phone down and I said, Hank, it's the press. They want a statement about the death threat. And Hank said, well, you can make it. And I said, Hank, I just walked in the door. I can't make a statement to the press about this death threat. And, of course, normally you wouldn't want somebody like that in a position of authority in an electoral campaign office. But it was obvious that Hank was, you know, marching to a different drummer and playing from a different playbook. And I immediately was drawn to him and thought, I need to get to know this person.
As a journalist, I can sincerely appreciate the sentiment you just expressed. If I'm not exactly sure if that had been me on the other end of the phone, how I probably would have taken that. Dan, let's talk a little bit about that time period when Hank was most active. I arrived in San Francisco, quite frankly, at the tail end of all of that. Take us back to that time period. How did you meet Hank, and what was it like? I mean, you literally were sitting there with your camera observing a lot of things from the perch at Harvey and Scott's shop to the streets to everything going on. What? Tell me and us, our listenership, a little bit about that time period.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, I actually met Hank Wilson he was a camera store customer at Harvey and Scott's camera store. I very distinctly remember writing his name on the envelopes for the film that he was dropping off, which is, you know, I used to pride myself on remembering all of my customers. That has disintegrated over time, but there's a few standouts, and I do remember scrawling his name very clearly. And he was a lovely guy, and I wasn't that involved with the groups that he was engaged with, such as Bay Area Gay Liberation Front. It took a few years for us to loop back around, but he was always he's kind of a zealot type character. You know, he was everywhere, very soft-spoken, and as Bob described, you know, pretty much a maverick. And, you know, and then many years later, We got to know each other a little bit through the Valencia Rose Cafe, which he helped found, and where a lot of the beloved avant-garde and comic talents of our days in the gay community, LGBT community, were getting their debuts. And I also had a star turn in that context. And so that was the melting pot for us. And then when Hank ran for supervisor in 2000, I did his headshots for that campaign. And, you know, he was at the street fairs. He was at everywhere. and always politicking and always with things that were, you know, really progressively minded and, you know, with great concern, as Bob said, for the underdog. Sexual health, definitely on that tip, and so much more.
I get Dan, let me do a quick follow-up, Rob. I get the impression from what Bob just said and from what you said and the little bit of background research I did that, like Harvey, Hank kind of didn't just have a solitary, singular focus on just the, back in those days, the, you know, the GLBT community, but, you know, he kind of extended his interest out. Harvey, of course, was senior citizens, the infamous dog poo campaign. But, I mean, it was, you know, it was like a broader reach. Would you say that that's accurate of Hank as well?
Yes, very much so. And I think the standout, in a sense, is when you think about today's burning issue of indigency and homelessness or houseless people, Hank was very much at the forefront of that conversation and doing something about it. I'll turn it over to Bob to talk about the Ambassador Hotel and how pivotal that that place was and how it became sort of a model for harm reduction ideation around housing and drug treatment and mental health treatment. And then later he founded TARC, Tenderloin Access Resource Center, and I had the good fortune of going to both of those places and seeing his work on the ground. And he's very quiet about it himself, but he was there and at the ground floor level.
Yeah, the Ambassador Hotel is pretty central to this story. So Hank was a kindergarten teacher, and his first activism was with gay teachers and getting employment protection for gay teachers, which was one in San Francisco before the Briggs Initiative, before all that. So he was very active in the gay liberation era of San Francisco and founded numerous organizations, including Bay Area Gay Liberation, Gay Action. He was very in the center of the first community self-defense efforts, the Carry a Whistle campaign, the Castro Street Patrol. He was involved in setting up one of the first gay community centers. The list goes on and on. But in 1978, he and his friend Ron Lanza, who was another teacher who had been fired over a gay issue, the two of them took over a 150-room residency hotel in the Tenderloin, single-room residency hotel in the Tenderloin. And this is a gigantic thing. I mean, 150 rooms is like a neighborhood. And it was really derelict. Most of the doors were off the hinges, and the rooms were just ratted out. And they took it over in 1978 with the intention of creating a refuge for queer street youth. And then very quickly, the AIDS epidemic arrived. And Hank spent the next 20 years, excuse me, spent the next 20 years running the Ambassador as an informal, unfunded, all queer staff refuge and hospice for homeless people dying of AIDS. And altogether, many hundreds of people died in Hank's hotel. And he did this without any government support, without any grants. He made this work as a private business. And this was at a time when all the money from San Francisco was being spent in the Castro. And people in the Tenderloin were just out of luck. And Hank did not accept this. He did not take no for an answer. And he pioneered a sort of harm reduction approach to housing indigent people with AIDS before the term harm reduction had even been coined. At the time, people with substance abuse issues who used were kicked out of city programs. And Hank's response was, well, maybe that was okay before AIDS, but these people are dying. And they have to go someplace to die. And there were people don't know this part of the AIDS story, but there were people who did extra time in prison because there was no place to release them to, because the halfway houses and parole programs wouldn't accept people who had HIV. So the Ambassador became known as the AIDS Hotel, and it was the only place that would accept parolees and addicts and people being released from hospital with no place to go because they didn't have money, transgender people who were kicked out of this, that, and the other place and had no place to go. And it's really quite an extraordinary story. And Hank did that for 20 years. And certainly that experience at the Ambassador is at the center of the Hank story. The crazy thing is, it's not the only thing he did. In the meantime, he did the first, you know, community-based AIDS research, and he was part of the founding of ACT UP, and he was part of the founding of People with AIDS, and he was, you know, opened the Valencia Rose, as Danny mentioned, the San Francisco's first gay cabaret and comedy club. He did all that in his spare time, while the rest of the time he was running a 150-room hotel as a hospice for homeless people dying of AIDS. Quite an extraordinary story.
Well, and at what point in this? Yeah, go ahead, Danny.
Oh, I just wanted to add that, you know, if we could just zoom forward for a minute, this is not a singular phenomena. I mean, basically, the Ambassador now is a shining jewel of social services housing with on-site counseling for the residents and so forth. So, basically, it is a success story, and it sounds like this really sort of really unruly phenomena that's a one-off, but it became the model of choice for a lot of municipalities all throughout the country. And he really kind of braved it and said, yes, this will work. And it did. I've known people that lived there.
And at what point in his experience there did he find out that he also was HIV positive, and how did he deal with his own facing of the disease personally?
Well, Hank, he found out he had AIDS through symptoms. You know, his first symptoms was hairy leukoplasia, which was one of the common opportunistic infections that people who had AIDS got. And he became quite sick in the mid-1990s and really got right down to death's door. He had dementia, he's covered with KS, checked into the hospital, and, you know, his friends thought, you know, he's never coming out. And bounced back, and then the protease inhibitors came out, and we finally had effective AIDS drugs, and Hank recovered. But those folks who really got down to having one foot in the grave before the new drugs became available, their immune systems were damaged, and it turned out that as time went on, they developed cancers and other things at much higher rates than the general population. So eventually Hank got lung cancer, even though he'd never smoked anything in his life. And so we don't typically think of lung cancer as an AIDS-related disease, but in Hank's case it was. And just to give you a sense of who Hank was, really an outside-the-box guy. I mean, Hank, his entire life in San Francisco, he lived in a tiny one-room, roach-infested apartment and slept on the floor. I mean, he didn't even have a bed. and he had homeless people sleeping in his car. He really did live a sort of monkish life. And I remember he called me up one day, and I was all tied up in knots about something that was so trivial that right now I can't even remember what it was. And I carried on and vented, all wrapped up in my own issues. And then after I had carried on for a while, I said, "So, Hank, how are you?" And I'll never forget, Hank said, "Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. I mean, I have lung cancer, but, you know, I spent the last 2 days at the medical library reading up on it, and you know what's so interesting is that people with lung cancer don't think they have any rights because they're all smokers, so this will be fun."
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Wow.
And that was Hank. Hank, you know, a lot of people who knew him wondered how he kept going. Everybody I've interviewed for the movie, and particularly the people who were involved in The Ambassador, are just sort of in awe of Hank's resilience and his ability to bounce back and his ability to forgive. It's interesting, Glenda Hope, who's a minister who worked in the Tenderloin for 41 years, told me that she thought that Hank's the person who really showed her what it was to be a forgiving person. And people who lived in the hotel during the worst of the AIDS epidemic talk about Hank's extraordinary ability to forgive. I mean, to get a picture of that hotel at the peak of the AIDS epidemic, remember there's 150 rooms in there. And there's a lot of junkies, there's people shooting up, there's, and you know, if everybody thinks they're dying, you know, there can be a, you know, throw caution to the winds sort of attitude. And one of the former residents told me that at one point there were one or two speed dealers on each floor in that hotel. And it was madness in there in a lot of ways. And Hank ran that for 20 years. And so many people around him were just kind of in awe of his resilience. And I think the resilience goes down to his ability to have fun. You know, he found fun in everything. He even found fun in getting a lung cancer diagnosis.
Hmm.
Wow. Amazing.
And it wasn't forced. It wasn't a put on, and it wasn't an act. It was Hank thought it was fun to bring people together and roll the dice and see what you could make out of this grouping of people and that grouping of people. I think that's why he founded so many organizations. You know, as soon as an organization that he started got on its feet and became the kind of thing that you could build a power base on, he wasn't interested. That was the point. He passed it off to somebody else and rolled the dice again to see what other thing he could create. And, never wanted credit for any of it. Always preferred to be behind the scenes. In fact, one of the more interesting interviews in the movie is with Lea Delaria, who is now a very well-known comic, and she's one of the stars of Orange is the New Black on Netflix. And she was a regular performer at the Valencia Rose, which was owned by, the Valencia Rose was owned by Hank and Ron as well. So Hank and Ron were running the Ambassador Hotel during the day and this comedy club during the night. And eventually Ron sort of ran the comedy club and Hank took on the hotel. But Leia was, you know, at the Valencia Rose every day, performing every week during this period. And at the end of the interview, I asked her, so did you know what Hank was doing during the day? And she said, no, tell me. And I said, well, he was running this 150-room hotel as an unfunded hospice for homeless people dying of AIDS. She had no idea.
Wow.
You know, she was seeing him every night. She had no idea because Hank did not blow his own horn, ever. He did not want, and it's one of the problems we've had with the movie because he also didn't want to be on camera. And we have so many stories of Hank trying to weasel his way out of pictures.
which
Leah DeLaria swears Leah swears that the Chronicle must have pictures of Hank trying to get out of pictures. Anyway, this is why I really wanted to make this movie. And of course, the joke is that Hank would not want this movie made about him.
Right. So in this movie, you have Leah involved. You have Tom Amiano involved. The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence and the Kronos Quartet. How did all these talented people come together for the movie?
Well, Hank was a longtime ally of the Sisters. He was one of the first people who was sainted by the Sisters. And so when I started this movie, I got in touch with the Sisters right away and said I was doing this. And, you know, this is one of your early saints. And and the Sisters jumped on board immediately. In fact, we filmed a quite beautiful ritual that the Sisters performed where they declare Hank the patron saint of, let's see, the ritual was done in the four cardinal directions, and they declared him the patron saint of queer underdogs, compassionate action, housing justice, and plague survivors. And there, I should mention we're raising money for this movie, and we're doing this money on less than a shoestring, which is the only way I can justify doing it, because I can just imagine what Hank would say if I told him I was making a movie about it. And he certainly wouldn't want money to be spent on a movie about him. In fact, here's another, just one of these beautiful Hank stories. I remember when he was dying in the hospital and he said he wanted to go home and die in his own bed. And I said, okay, well, that's fine, but that means we have to buy you a bed, you know, because he slept on the floor. And I'm not kidding. He said, well, okay, but don't spend a lot of money. So we got him a cheap bed to go home to die in. At any rate, so the one thing that I need to raise money for this movie is the animation, because Hank weaseled his way out of so many pictures that he left a fairly scant photographic record. Dan Nicoletta, who's here with us tonight, he has some photos, and other people have some still photos, but there's very, very little footage. The kind of photographic trail that one would expect for a person of this level of accomplishment just isn't there. So we're going to use animation in place of the missing footage. And animation is extremely labor intensive. And I have a wonderful animator, Jeremy Rourke, who uses paper and scissors. with his animation. So he's taking the photos we have and he's cutting them up and making them into animation. But it's just extremely labor intensive, and he does have to pay the rent and eat every now and then while he's doing this. So we're doing a Kickstarter campaign to raise the money to pay for the animation. And I really, anybody who's listening and wants to contribute to this, if you just go to Kickstarter and look for Thanks to Hank, which is the name of the movie is Thanks to Hank, which comes from his memorial in the Castro, after the memorial people spontaneously left the memorial and marched down Castro Street chanting Thanks to Hank. So that's where the title comes from. The Kronos Quartet is donating the music. They gave me access to their entire recorded catalog and said, have whatever you want. I think I mentioned I'm a composer, and I've worked with the Kronos Quartet before. They're good friends. I first worked with them, I don't know if people remember, but back in the early 90s, there was a riot in San Francisco after then-Governor Pete Wilson vetoed a law that would have given housing protection to people with AIDS. And I took my tape recorder to that riot and recorded it and transcribed it for the string quartet. I actually made a string quartet out of a gay riot, and they premiered it at Lincoln Center. We had gay riot night at Lincoln Center. I was very proud of that. And they made it into a CD, and that was all wonderful. I've stayed close friends with them ever since. Also, the Tin Hat Trio, a wonderful sort of chamber music group from San Francisco, is also donating music. We've got Matt Bautista, a talented young cinematographer, has been donating that work. A lot of the work I'm just doing myself. I Hank died too soon, and a lot of us who were very close to him felt like we didn't really have a chance to say thank you. Like I said, I've always been very clear in my mind that at some point I needed to do something for Hank to tell him thank you for everything he did. So I'm very happy to be doing all of. I'm learning to edit movies and so forth.
Yeah, no, that sounds amazing.
Where
are you guys?
We do need to raise money for the animation.
Yeah, where are you in the production? How much of the film has already been done or is in progress?
Oh, we're far along. All the interviews have been done. I have a fantastic interview with Donna Lisa Stewart, who was Hank's assistant manager at the Ambassador for 13 years. She's a now elderly transgender woman who actually started her career touring with the Jewel Box Review, which was a sort of pre-Stonewall professional touring group of female impersonators. And really, she's had quite the life, and then ended up as the assistant manager at the Ambassador. And that's a fantastic interview. We have an interview with Jerry Kirby, who was a resident of the Ambassador back in the early days and is still living there in the same room that Hank gave him when he had no money to pay. And interviews with Tom Amiano, Hank's early collaborator, interviews with Esteban Rodriguez and Stephanie Joy Ashley, who are much younger activists who are sort of the new generation inspired by Hank. We have the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, who've performed this gorgeous ritual, which was shot by Leo Herrera, very talented young cinematographer. So we're quite far along, and we're hoping that it will premiere at the Frameline Film Festival in San Francisco next summer. Of course, you know, that's up to them. I've applied, and The very first film festival was at Hank's community center, which was just a room over a garage. And so it would be fitting if the film premiered at that festival. So we're pretty far along. What we have to do is we have to drop in the animation, and the animation is going to sort of tie the film together and make it all work. So so the big job right now is to get the money. And again,
right.
Jeremy's working for pennies on the dollar for what an animator would normally charge, but it's a lot of work doing animation.
No, absolutely. So you mentioned the film festival. Is that the primary first stop of distribution of the film, or do you have other things planned beyond that to get the film out there once it's made?
Well, that would certainly be our hope. You know, since Hank was so rooted in San Francisco and, you know, such a pillar of the LGBT community of San Francisco, and since the original film festival was held in his community center, the Frameline Festival is our logical first stop, and our hope is that they will be given a place of prominence. All the other queer film festivals, send people to Frameline to see what's up at Frameline. So hopefully, if we get a prominent place at Frameline, that will be a good vehicle for expanding the reach around the world. We're also going to be pursuing the animation festival world, which will be a completely different world. There's actually a developing genre of animated documentaries. And so we're hoping to pursue that as well. For many years, I did performances with Pierre Hébert, who's an animator from the National Film Board of Canada, and he's advising me in that regard. And we've had initial conversations with public television in San Francisco. So, my hope is that, there has become a sort of canon of LGBT history. And what I mean by that is that if you're a college student these days, if you're a college student these days and you're interested in LGBT history, there's a very small number of books and movies that you've seen. You've seen The Times of Harvey Milk, you've seen Before Stonewall. It's a short list. And my hope is that somehow, thanks to Hank, we'll end up in that list. I don't think it's going to be, a blockbuster movie or a household word. But my hope is that younger queers coming on the scene and wanting to know their history will know that there was this kind of gay activism that really thought about class and really thought about the least privileged among us.
And
I think on that note, I'm
going
to interject something. Go ahead, Rob.
Go ahead, Brody. Go ahead.
Well, the thing that strikes me, and Dan, you and I have been kind of listening to this because this is really fascinating, but, in many ways, this kind of brings a lot of things full circle, at least in terms of, the history of the community and, more importantly, the legacy of the community, especially for someone like Hank or, even someone who was as out there as Harvey. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, the time is now to make the film, and we can't do it without support from the community. And really, because when Bob and I are 6 feet under, the activism necessary to foster the preservation of the narrative will also disappear. And so we want to celebrate Hank while we're here to do it. And we need the community support. And so that is full circle, because that's always how the LGBT movement has done things. And Hank was no stranger to that. There's some amazing footage of him as a student at UCLA. and he's talking philosophically, and you could see that he already has this incredible, strong vision in play. And so while he was very modest in terms of, you know, visibility, that, you know, there was a solid aspect to how he did things and why he did things right from the beginning. And it's just, you know, Bob found this footage and it's absolutely breathtaking, and we need to get that out there.
Yeah, I do hope this is somewhat of a blockbuster, because I feel like there's a large part of the population that needs to understand the legacy, that the history that's behind them, their experiences, that it's just, you know, about marriage equality, and, you know, it's, you know, RuPaul's Drag Race, and, you know, very cultural top level stuff. And I don't think that they fully grasp the environment that this all came from, of the horror of AIDS, and a community that felt completely marginalized and ignored, and somebody like Hank coming along and pulling us up from our bootstraps. So I think what you're doing is extremely important. Guys, we're almost running out of time here. Tell people how they can get involved.
Go to Kickstarter and type in "Thanks to Hank." It's very simple. You don't need a URL or anything. Just go to Kickstarter and search for "Thanks to Hank." There will be clips from the movie. There will be a page with photographs and a whole explanation of what we're doing. There will be links to the work by the animator, Jeremy Rourke. And you click on the button. We've got rewards. We've got gifts, all kind of things. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, on November 20th at the Tenderloin Museum, we're doing a fundraising party with drag performances by Grace Towers and auctioning off artwork by Mrs. Vera. And but the main thing is, go to Kickstarter, type in "Thanks to Hank." You know, the whole concept of Kickstarter is you don't have to give a lot of money, because you can reach a lot of people. The minimum donation is $1. And then share that link with your friends, pass it on. We have to raise $15,000 to make this Kickstarter thing work, and we're at about $3,000 now, so we've got $12,000 to go. It's kind of making me panic a little bit, because I'm not a fundraiser. This is not my forte. I think I'm going to make a pretty good movie if we can get the money. So
we're right there with you. I want to thank you both for coming on tonight. The movie is going to be "Thanks to Hank." Go to Kickstarter to be a part of it. Bob Ostertag and Daniel Nicoletta, I want to thank you guys for coming on with us and being part of Rated LGBT Radio. I want to thank Brody Levesque, as always, for his expertise and insight and everything that he does on the show and outside of the show. Also, you'll hear Brody and myself this Saturday on Out in Santa Cruz. Then you can listen to that Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time, www.ksco.com, and that will be another live show there. And most of all, I want to thank you for listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We will get back here again next week with another really important show that you will need to hear. Same bat time, same bat channel, and we look forward to talking to you then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!